Yes, the program for today is mouse dynamics and signature verification. And we'll start with mouse dynamics. When I first worked a bit on mouse dynamics, I started looking for literature and I found something about mice biometrics. And that could be cool, right? Mouse and just multiple mouses, mice. But that was actually the biometric identification of mice. Very nice article from colleagues in Sweden. And what they did is they looked at the ear and looked at the vein patterns there. So interesting, but not related to what we are going to do today. So today I'll first give an introduction on the topic and then a bit of history in there also. I'll say something about the raw data that we can collect and the features that we can extract from that. And then I'll present results in static and continuous mouse dynamics, where static is everything related to getting access. So it includes also what we discussed last week, the challenge-based and free mouse dynamics in this case, and continuous actually is not continuous in this particular case. It's related to reconfirming the identity, and in fact it will be a short bit on periodic mouse dynamics. So let's start with the introduction. In mouse dynamics, like in keystroke dynamics where we measure how we use the keyboard, in mouse dynamics we'll measure how we use the mouse, and we'll see if there are distinctive features in there that can be used to separate one person from another. Very few pictures that really represent a mouse. I can show a computer mouse, but that's not really very informative. What kind of potential features can we use in mouse dynamics? We can look at the direction that somebody moves the mouse. We can look at how fast he moves the mouse or how fast he clicks left or right button. How far does he move? Not how fast, but how far. Is it just a small move, or is it a long move, or these kinds of things. And the deviation from a straight line. If he's going from point A to point B with a mouse pointer, is he going straight, or is he just all over the place, or whatever. So we can measure something there also. How much do we deviate from our goal? It's actually very suitable for periodic or continuous authentication. Yeah, during getting access to the computer, we generally don't use a mouse that much, or if we use it very little. But during the normal use of a computer, we use the mouse continuously. All of the time, we alternate between keyboard and mouse, and so we have a lot of data there. And so we could very well use it for periodic / continuous authentication. If we want to use it for static authentication, then actually we have to design a special kind of task for a person to perform with a mouse. Small bit of history. The mouse was actually invented only in 1964. By then it was a small wooden box with two wheels in there that could measure horizontal or vertical movements. Very rudimentary. 8 years later, they came with this device, which is a ball mouse. Not sure if you ever use them. That was a major hassle because this ball was turning around when you move the mouse, and there were some sensors inside that could measure that movement. But if you used it a lot, then that ball would get greasy, and then the sensor wouldn't work, and so you had to take it apart, and you had to clean the ball and everything. And glad that is over because, again, 8 years later, they came with the optical mouse. Initially, there was a lot of interference from reflection of the table or whatever you use it on, but yeah, that improved also. So that's more or less the mouse that we're using now: optical mouse, laser mouse, these kinds of things. This is a mouse. I'm not sure if you can really see it here, where there is a fingerprint scanner built in. At a logical place that if you normally put your hand on the mouse, then you can see this. Then your finger is actually, your thumb is actually over this fingerprint scanner, and you could, in principle, measure the fingerprint of a person every time that he uses the mouse. That's not what we consider in mouse dynamics in this case. If we look at static mouse dynamics, we look at literature over in that case, there is very little of that. There is a number of tasks that, as I said, you should have a particular task. There's a number of tasks that have been researched. One of them is typing your new username by clicking on an on-screen keyboard, or typing your PIN code, and in order to avoid that people could really easily see what PIN code somebody typed, they randomized the keyboard there. For the username, that's not that important, but for the PIN code, it might be more important. Moving the mouse through a maze, so you get a maze, and then you have to move the mouse, so you have a lot of mouse movements there, not so many clicks. In the first two, you have a number of clicks and moves between clicks. When navigating through a maze, you don't have that many clicks, but you have a lot of movements. Clicking on dots, and that could be dots that appear at once on the screen, or that could appear separately. Once I clicked on one, then the new one is appearing, or whatever. Memory game. We all know this child's play that we had. We have this bunch of cards, and you turn around two, and if they have the same picture on it, you keep them. If not, you turn them back, but you have to remember which image was where. And then actually a very logical one is writing a signature with your mouse. So I take the mouse and I move it around in the way that I would normally move a pen when writing my signature, and then you get something on the screen that looks like your signature. So there's a number of ways of giving the user a task to use the mouse and then analyzing the data to give the user access. So let's have a bit of a closer look at that. The first one was clicking your username and PIN code. That was by Gamboa, Fred, and Jane. And they use an on-screen keyboard. They had their own specific keyboard design. I'm not sure. They could have used, in principle, the one that Windows have available already. Although I'm not sure if you click on this, if you measure it, if you can still give the information through to the to the application. But they use the normal keyboard for the typing the or clicking the username, and then they had a smaller one with a randomized layout for the PIN code. So if you had to type your PIN code 1234, that's 1234, and the next time you get a different layout. So you do have to remember your PIN code, and you still have to figure out where the numbers are. In this case, this is clearly static. The keyboard layout is the same every time. Your username is the same every time. The way that you perform the task might differ slightly, but yeah, it's pretty fixed. In this case, it's a bit challenge-based. It's a mixture between challenge-based and static, because the PIN code that you're typing is the same, but the layout is different every time. And actually, that work was building on something by Gamboa and Ferreira, and they looked at this memory game. And actually, they said they used this memory game to collect this kind of data, moving the mouse in a small area and clicking on different locations. That would somehow give similar data that could also be used for clicking on your username or clicking on the PIN code. So that's that claim. The movements are similar. And there are some reasons to use a game. What would be a good reason to not give the keyboard and type your and click your name a number of times? What would be a reason to use a game in this case? Well, one of the reasons is my username is 8 characters, so that's 8 clicks. Here I have 18 positions, and I have to play, of course, and every time that I play this game, it's not just 18 clicks, because in this case, They found already this image, but these two images are not the same, so they will be turned back. So you have to play a lot, and so you're clicking more than just when clicking your username. So that's one reason. What could be another reason? What is more fun? Clicking your username or doing this? Speaking for myself, this is more interesting, at least to me. So users seem to be more cooperative in the data collection part. Yeah. But then I have a question. So they say, okay, we're collecting similar data to what we would have when we were type the username or click the username and click the PIN code. But my question to you is, do you agree on that? Will the behavior be the same? Yeah, think about the memory game. Think about the online keyboard or number pad. Will your behavior be the same? I see two people who think it's not. Is there anybody who thinks it is the same? It's a click and then a moving and a clicking and a moving and a clicking, right? That's in both cases. Yeah, but in this case, it's unknown. You don't know where to move. If I type my username, I know where the letters of the keys are. If I type the PIN code, yes, I have to search where 1, 2, 3, 4 is. Yeah, but I see that. Here it's more random. And then all of a sudden I have seen if these two disappear and here the maple leaf appears again, I have to think where the previous one was. Instead of knowing that I had just typed this letter and now I have to type that letter, which is C. So it's on some level it will be the same, but I think I would agree that my behavior would be different. That has not been tested. That could be an interesting test.
So it's not tested if you, for instance, do the memory game and then compare to how your mouse moved when clicking your username.
No. Okay. They have collected. They have given the keyboard and the mouse pad from the previous screen as the application while they collected data with this game.
Okay.
And so they just said that the movements are similar, and hence the results can be ported from the memory game to the other one.
Okay. Yeah?
But that could be an interesting question. Okay. Same as, I'm not sure how much I stressed that yesterday. I guess we'll come to that when we talk about continuous authentication next week. About copying a text from screen or from paper versus coming up with your own text and typing that. Yeah, we'll come to that next time. The maze, actually it's quite an easy maze, right? I know where to go in this maze. Maze is not a good word, of course. But the idea was to click on the start button to move your mouse between these lines all the way up to the end button, which was activated once you click the start button. Yeah, they're soft, the boundaries are soft. So somebody could just cheat and go straight there. This is research that we did here 9 years ago, 2008, a master student. And luckily all the participants were nice enough to follow the maze instead of going straight. You see a number of horizontal and vertical moves. And so, yeah, we could measure something from that. Clicking on dots. There are many different variations to that. Here you see a number of dots. You see already where the dots are. There is one green dot in this particular case. That's the one that you have to click. Other applications just showed a new dot once I click the old dot. You could say they have to be clicked in a particular order. That can be shown with the... with the colors. Maybe there is numbers on the dots that already I can see. If I'm looking for the current dot, if I have to look for dot number 4, and while looking for it, I see dot number 5. I know where to go next, but after only I found dot 4 and click on that. Or maybe I just freely click on the dots, just click on them as fast as possible, for example, whatever order. In this particular case, once clicking on a dot, it became blue, and a new dot became green. And so over time, there were a number of blue dots, and the number of red dots was shrinking until somebody was completely finished. This was not from one session. As you see, the dots are always in different places. Yeah, in principle, if I have my constellation, the dots will stay on those places. Otherwise, it's not useless, not useful. We could display the dots randomly or fixed positions. Yeah, so if you have fixed locations of the dots, somebody could learn over time where the next dot will be instead of searching for which dot now has become green in this particular application. Yeah, or I place them randomly and every time that I have to search again. And so you could, in terms of the types of authentication, static authentication would mean it's always fixed. Challenge-based could be that there is variation in it, and free mouse dynamics could be something like, okay, here are the dots, just click on them. Or maybe not even showing dots. But if you want this to clicking on the dots, then you just show them on. There have been variations also where you did not need to click on the dot. You just, your mouse pointer should go to where the dot is, and once it reaches that area, you can go to the next one. A mouse lock. This is a lock from a safe. And a lock from a safe, I'm not sure if you ever use it, but you have to turn it a number of rotations, and then you turn it, let's say, clockwise until a certain number, and then you turn it counterclockwise to another number, and again, etc., etc. And there was an analogy made of this. There's a number of pictures. You can't see it, but these are cars. A number of pictures there. And so what I'll do with the mouse, I'll go to a particular picture, and I click left or right button to indicate clockwise or counterclockwise. And then the picture was changed in the sense that that particular picture that I clicked was turned to the upper position, so the whole dial was turned, and then I could go to the next one where I would click with the other mouse button, and I could alternate that a bit. So clicking on a picture will rotate that disc, and left and right is clockwise or counterclockwise is done by using the left and right click button. And in this case, they had you had to click on 5 images, so you had to repeat that procedure 5 times. Actually, there was a variation in types of images also. And then the last one was what I said is writing your signature with a mouse. There are some advantages and disadvantages over that. Moving with a mouse might not feel really natural as same with a pen. And in the times that I have used such devices, what you often see is that there is a lag between showing on the screen what I've been doing and actually doing this, or the other way around. I do something and then it appears on the screen slightly later. And so you get some hesitation. Hey, did it really measure what I just did or not? You have to obviously click down a button and release the button to go to have a break in the signature. And I guess if this person would write his normal signature, it would look slightly like this, but this is very rough. So that is some of the research that was done on static authentication. And most of the research actually falls within these categories. There's very little research done in this area. Let's look at what kind of data we can collect when using a mouse versus what kind of features we can extract. First of all, the mouse move. Yeah, in principle, when I move the mouse, I can track the time and where the mouse pointer is. So I have the timing information and I have location information. X and Y. And then, yeah, with an index I, because I have multiple measurements, of course. Depending on the refresh frequency of the mouse, I get more or less of these values. When I talk about mouse move, but that is not for all people, a mouse move would be something that started with not moving the mouse and ended with not moving the mouse. And so if I'm moving the mouse, yeah, and I started here, and I stopped here, then apparently before this, I wasn't moving the mouse for a while, and after this, I am not moving the mouse for a while. In principle, if you look at repeated information of timing and location, yeah, I could say this, from there to there, is a mouse move. But before that, I was moving the mouse, and after that, I was moving the mouse. Yeah, again, there are slight differences in what terminology is used in literature. But yeah, I would say a mouse move is from not starting and then moving the mouse until you no longer move it. So that's mouse move. Then there is mouse click. Not a lot of things that we can do with a mouse. Clicking is similar as with the keystroke dynamics. I press down the button and I release the button. So I have a time when I press it down, and I have a time T0, and I have a time T1 when I release the mouse button. And I can see if it was a left button or a right button that I clicked. That's interesting also. And where did I click this? Actually, where did I click it? I could also look at where was the mouse pointer when I started, when I pressed down the button, and where was it when I released it. Generally, these are obviously close together, but they don't need to be exactly the same. I could also look at the area where I clicked. Did I click on a button, okay, or cancel? Did I activate a window? Did I activate a pull-down menu? So what was the result of my action? That could be interesting too. If I look at a double click, then I can collect this information for the first click, and I can collect it again for the second click. And then I have all the information that I can collect. That's nothing more, nothing less. If I wanted to know how long time there was between the two clicks, well, I know the release from the first, and I know the press from the second click, and so I have some information there. I know where the pointer was when I released the first button, and when I pressed it again, I also know. So I have similar information also there on how much did the mouse pointer move during or between the two clicks. Another action that I can do with a mouse is point and click. So what I do there is I move my mouse and I click on a particular area. Generally, my mouse pointer is not over where I want to click, so I have to go there. So mouse move is just moving it somewhere. And point and click is moving the mouse pointer and then clicking on a specific location that I'm interested in. Obviously, so that's more common. Could be that I want to activate a window and I see that the mouse is already over that window, so it's easy to click. But generally, we have to move it. There is a difference between a point and click versus a mouse move and a mouse click. If I do a point and click, I do assume that I move the mouse and click. If I do a mouse move, I move the mouse, I wait, and if I do a mouse click afterwards, I click. So the time between the end of the mouse move and the start of the mouse click is short when I'm talking about a point and click, and will be longer when it is a mouse move followed by a mouse click. And then we have a drag and drop as the last one. And you can see a drag and drop as a special kind of mouse move, or you can actually also see it as a special kind of mouse click if you want. So what do you do with the drag and drop? In principle, you are at a location, you click your mouse, you press down the button, and then you start moving. You're moving a window or whatever, and then later on you release. the button. So you start with the mouse press down button event, then you move the mouse, and then you release the mouse button. Why is this a special mouse move? Well, because I start with a click and end with a release of that. I start with a press of the button and I end with a release. Why is this a special kind of mouse click? Well, actually, I do the same as a mouse click. I know when the mouse click starts and when it ends. And I know the difference in location, if you want. Where did I start when I clicked and where did I end when I clicked? But I have a larger time that it takes. Mouse click is fast, a drag and drop takes more time. Generally, the displacement in a mouse click is very very small, and in a drag and drop can be very large. So the difference is in time and also in displacement in general. Although I could have a small adjustment of a window, so it could also be the displacement does not need to be small. Does not need to be large, of course. Yeah, so that's a bit about the raw features that I can extract, mostly on the mouse move and the mouse click, of course, and then combinations of that. What features can we then extract that we can use in the analysis, in the comparison? So if you look at mouse click or mouse double click, I can say something about the duration of that click. When did I press the button and when did I release it? I can say something about the displacement in X and Y direction between where I pressed it and where I released it. I could do it less specific, so not so much in X and Y direction. I could just look at the Euclidean distance between the two. It doesn't matter how much X and Y displacement there is. I look at the total distance that I travel. If I look at a double click, then I have these features, whatever selection I have of that for the first click, and I have them for the second click, but I also have them for the time in between, for the latency. And if you look at what other timing features I could do, I could maybe say something about the total time starting to click the first button to releasing the second button. The up-down time is, of course, the normal latency that we talk about. Down-time, up-up-down, all very similar to what we have done in keystroke dynamics. And the only difference with keystroke dynamics is that I just have two keys, a left button and a right button. All the rest is there. And here I have information about location that I don't have with the keyboard. So mouse clicks and mouse double clicks don't give that much information. So let's see what happens when we look at mouse movements. Actually, here you see that people have come up with many different kind of features that they could use. So let's have a short look at that. Assume that we have n data points. Yeah, so I have timing information and location information for I is 1 up to n, because that's how long my mouse move took. And then I can have some simple features. Can anybody come up with a feature that could describe this mouse move? Well,
speed.
Sorry?
Speed.
Yeah, speed. That's in there soon. Total time. Well, we can start with the total time. How long did it take me to make that mouse move? Speed is another one.
Acceleration,
yeah, the derivative of that again. Yeah. The length, yeah. What is the length?
From here to here.
So here is my mouse move, my previous mouse move. Let me see if this is working. I started here, and I ended here, right? What is the length that I now travel? Yeah, okay. So the length of this line, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But wouldn't length depend on the acceleration and the speed of the mouse?
Yeah.
No, 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 not if I have coordinates x1, y1 here and xm.
For instance, if you take a mouse and you say, like if you have a mouse pad and I take the mouse and move it slowly from this position to that position.
Sure, then the speed is lower.
Yeah, and the speed is lower. And if I do the same with higher speed, wouldn't the length that the mouse traveled on the screen increase?
the length is simply the distance between where I started and where I ended up. So it doesn't matter if I go very slow on this track or if I go very fast. Yeah, this is just purely where was the mouse when I started, the mouse pointer when I started, where was it when I ended?
Yeah, I was thinking physically.
Yeah, sure. I understand what you mean. No. This is purely what the mouse pointer is doing on the the screen. So total time we had. The point of displacement, that's actually what you said, the distance from here to here. Let's see if we have better. I can actually look if there is sampling points in between. And if I move slow, then these sampling points will be close together. If I start moving faster, and then these sampling points will be further apart, and then I can move slow again for a while. Yeah, so I have a number of sampling points. And actually I can measure the length of the path that I traveled, the total distance traveled. So I look at the distance between this point and this point, and then I look at the distance between these two sampling points, et cetera, all the way up to here, the last one. And then I can say, not so much from where did I start, where did I go, so the total display, the point of displacement, but I can look at the total distance traveled. I can look at the average speed, so that's speed what you mentioned, and then also the from that the acceleration. So what I'll do is I'll look at the displacement for between two points, and I divide it by the time. If I know the speed that I had on this first small track and then on the second track, etc., etc., all the way up to the end. Yeah. So that is the speed of the trajectory that I followed. You could also say something about the total displacement of the pointer divided by the time it took. So I went from here to here. Yeah, and it took me so long. So that's also a kind of speed. We can look at the direction of the movement. I started here and I ended up there, so it was in that direction. And to have 360 directions, that's a bit over the top, because the probability that I would hit the same direction again is low. So what they have done is look at different regions of movement. And so there is a region from 0 to 45 degrees and everything in that direction. What is it? North, northwest. East, north to northeast, is within that group. And then northeast to east is within a group. Yeah, and so this would be in that second group. And you can split that disk into multiple regions if you think it's interesting, or less regions. And so I can look at the direction of the movement. There is something like, I can look at the angle. So I move from, here the numbering is wrong also there. I move from here to here, so I have the displacement, what did I call it? The point of displacement length, and I have the total, that's the length of this dashed line. I have the traveled path, so that's the length of that straight line. And then I have some kind of origin somewhere. Yeah, and I calculate the angle between the x-axis and the point where I am, and I look at that angle. Yeah, so that angle is decreasing in this particular case, and then it will decrease, and at some point it will increase again. You can look at a different angle. If you look at the two endpoints, and I look at a point on the travel path, I can look at this angle also. And you can define angle in different ways. Yeah?
These features, are they individually, could you say something about who's using the mouse based on the direction they're moving the mouse? I mean, when you work on a computer,
and you're identifying if you're trying to. Each of these features by itself will not be, cannot be used as an identifier because it is giving you too little information. But the sum, of, because in the mouse movement we have already discussed a few simple ones and now some more elaborate ones. Yes, if you use all of that information together, you can identify people from that or authenticate people from that.
So I could have a tendency to move my mouse in northeast direction more often than.
No. Oh, sorry. No. In that case, maybe your behavior in this direction will be slightly different from your behavior in this direction.
Okay.
Yeah. And so what we'll do is we'll split up movement in this direction and look at the number of features in compared to other directions. Yeah. So that by itself is not a real distinction. Although I can imagine people maybe moving the mouse more up and down, so more in these regions or more in these regions. That could be, I don't know.
Are there research on typical groups of computer users? For instance, those who only work or those who only play video games and how they move their mouse?
No, not as such. That could be interesting.
You look if they are very similar.
Yeah. For keystroke dynamics, you can very easily determine a gamer.
Yes, of course, you can just look how he sits down on a keyboard.
Sorry, say again?
I think you can just look how he places keys on the keyboard.
We have collected some continuous authentication data, and then we saw that gamers used, AWSD, a lot. Or that area, I'm not sure. I'm not a gamer, so yeah. So they use those keys a lot. So by just the sheer magnitude of that amount, that type of key, we could determine that. For the mouse, I don't know.
Okay.
But as we can determine a mouse, a gamer, by the keystroke data, we could split our data into gamers and non-gamers and see if then the mouse data will give some information about that. So how do you think that a gamer uses the mouse different from?
No, I have no idea. I was just thinking that maybe if you compare, if you have 10 individuals that use a computer differently, for instance, instead of having 10 gamers that only play video games at their computer, are they?
Yeah.
Like maybe that will be or they will be very.
I could imagine that a gamer would go more straight to his target.
Yeah.
So a normal computer user is searching where he has to go, and oh yeah, I have to go there. A gamer might be targeting towards that target much faster and go in a more straight line. That could be a way, but otherwise, yeah. I don't know. Sounds like interesting research. Could be a term paper next year. So we can look at angles, for example. An interesting feature that is used a lot is displacement. Here again, we have the trajectory of going from the start to the beginning. And I look at how far I'm deviating from my straight line. And you can look, for example, at the maximum displacement. So here I'm furthest away from my target. And maybe I can look at the average displacement, etc., etc. You can always say that, okay, this, I started here, I ended there. This is my target. And then how much did somebody deviate from that based on this dashed line? However, I know my own behavior is I start using the mouse, and then I'm the mouse is moving a bit already, and then I'm looking for where I should go. And then once I have determined that, I could go in a straight line. But in this case, if suppose that I was here, and I was going in a straight line, here, then still I had a lot of displacements for all the sampling points. Which is somehow unfair, because at some point I decided to go in a straight line. So the displacement, here it's defined based on the line between start and stop. I could define the displacement here if I would have gone in a straight line from here to the end point, then the displacement would be very short, for small for this one. While here it's a large value. Yeah, so you can also, if you want, define the displacement from the point that, from displacement for this point is from the point where I was to the end point, that straight line, and then the distance to that straight line. I haven't seen that used, but you could use it also. I could look at the area under the curve also. Yeah, what's the area that I'm slightly different. Obviously it's related to the maximum displacement and everything and the mean displacement, but there's a slight difference there. I could look at the length of the path that I traveled in relation to the minimum that I could have done. I can't do any better than going straight from the beginning to the end in a straight line. And then the displacement will be zero, and the area on the curve will be zero, and then this ratio will be one. But generally, I will deviate from the yellow path, and so I will have some value here, that ratio that will be larger than one. Or if you turn around, will be less than one. And there are more features that you can extract. Given the time, we're talking now for 3/4 of an hour, and the fact that I just came to the overview again, I would say let's have a 10-minute break, and I will continue right after that. All right? Any questions? Yeah.
It would be, now it costs some money, so it would be specialized, I guess, for secret applications to money or something. But I guess those sensors will be cheap and will come.
Yeah. There has been research on the way that the eye moves when you look at a screen, right? You can measure that. There's it's relatively cheap equipment, either with a camera from the screen, or we had special glasses also for that you put on and that follow the movement of your pupil, of your iris. Again, very similar to mouse dynamics and very similar to signature verification, because you have a trajectory that you're following, and you have maybe on the display you display some pictures, and every time that I have, well, not moving my head, but every time with my eyes I have to find the next picture that is displayed or something like that. Or maybe a picture is displayed and as a secret I look at specific areas in a specific order or something like that. Or with my eyes, in terms of the maze, with my eyes I'll make the movement through the maze. And you can measure that, and you can do some research on that. And there has been done research on this also. More interesting, but then going from behavioral to biological biometrics, is your eyes make very small movements also. If your eyes would be perfectly still, you wouldn't see anything. Yeah, so your eyes make very small movements, involuntary, and so you could, with more expensive equipment obviously, you can also measure that. And then, I'm not sure if it's personal, but I can imagine that this is a personal, I'm not sure how to call it, tremble or whatever. I'm making a large movement. It's obviously not that large unless you're drunk. Yeah, it's very, very small. Yeah? I can, if you're interested, I can see if I can have some points for you for that eye tracking research. Okay. Okay. Cool. Yeah. Any more questions? If not, let's have a 10-minute break then. Okay, so let's look at some of the results in static keystroke dynamics. So we'll go over more or less the same applications that I described earlier. So the first one is this username pin clicking research, where actually we're looking at the memory game. They had 50 volunteers and 10 minutes of memory game playing per volunteer. And those such a game looks a bit like this. You see plus is a clicking and then in the moves in between. And it's difficult to see from there, but the there were actually 32 clicks here to reveal all the 18 images. So obviously you're clicking more than the number of images because you have to return back to a particular image later on. Apparently somebody is doing it rather random. He's starting here, I assume, and then the next click will be somewhere here, I think the third picture on the third line, instead of just clicking very systematic. So different people might play the game in different ways. Anyway, they had 10 minutes of memory game per user. They define a stroke as the movement between two clicks, so the movement here between that click and the next click, that's a stroke. And then again, between that click and the next click is a stroke, etc., etc. They had at least 400 strokes per user, and so they decided to cut it off at 400 because that's the amount that everybody had. And if you had more, then 400 strokes were just chosen at random from the amount that a user had. And then I split it 50-50. They trained the system with 200 strokes, and they did testing with the other 200. They used a 63-dimensional feature vector because they're just looking at moves. They have a lot of information there. As I said, you can extract a lot of different features from that. So they use 63 different features from a particular move. They use spatial information and temporal information. And then they reflected that back to what would that mean if I would type a n-digit pin code. And in principle, when I type an n-digit pin code, I would assume you have n minus 1 strokes, unless you would also maybe include clicking enter after that, or clicking start at the beginning, or whatever. Right? This was my interpretation. Later on, I noticed that they apparently had a slightly different interpretation, where an n-digit pin meant n strokes. So okay, that's okay, no worries. So the performance depends on the number of strokes, of course. If they use 6 strokes, they got an equal error rate of 17%, and that decreased to 6% when your pin length was, I think, 16, but they wrote 15 there. 15 strokes, so I would assume a 16-digit pin. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. Remembering a 15 or a 16-digit pin is obviously a difficult task. I've shown some curves also for that, and they used 10 and 15 digits, 10 and 15 strokes here, and 10 and 15 digit pin codes here. So that's where I assume that they either have a click at the end or a click in the beginning that I did not take into account. So they get let's say reasonable equal errors, but at a high cost of somebody remembering a long pin. The mouse lock. The idea was that if you know your secret combination, if you know you should click on the white car first, that will then move up, and then the next one is the yellow car. Well, that yellow car will end up here then. Yeah, if you know that it will end up there, you can faster than an adversary move to that particular location. Even if an adversary knows the order of your cars, he still has to look for that. So the features that they used were timing information, speed-related information. They had an experiment with a full 6 users, and the enrollment was using the system 5 times correctly, so with no mistakes in between. And then from those 5 entries, the reference was calculated. And for the testing, each user entered his own secret 100 times, and each of the five other secrets, because there were six users, they entered it 20 times. So in terms of genuine scores and imposter scores, I could calculate 100 genuine scores for a particular user, because that's his own attempts. And I can calculate 5 times 20, also 100 imposter scores, because all of the five users are trying to mimic me. They reported on a per user basis the equal error rate, but on average, that the false match, false non-match rate, on average that gave a false match rate of 3.5% and a false non-match rate of 4%. And that was on five, you had to click on five secrets, right? Five pictures. There are different categories of images. So this is cars. They had faces also. That I don't know what the other categories was. There was four different categories, and actually there was one extra category, so the fifth category, which was a mixture of all these pictures. So not one typical set, but anything goes. If they look at how fast somebody could enter their secret, that went from 6.7 seconds when they looked at cars to 9.3 seconds when the set was mixed. And the error rates was actually lowest for face images, where there was just a 1% false match and false non-match rate. In terms of keeping the secret, you see that's five. There's 18 images on a dial. So every time, if I have to guess a secret, I have to guess 18, one out of 18 images five times. That's not really secrets. Better, of course, than a PIN code, but it's not that much. Then, clicking the dots, slightly different from the pictures that I showed before. In this case, a dot appeared on the screen, and I had to go to that dot. I didn't need to click it. Once I reached it, it disappeared, and a new dot appeared. There were 10 dots in total. The article actually did not mention if that would be in a fixed location every time, so that I already know when I reach one dot where to go, where the next dot will appear, or if they appeared completely at random. They didn't write that down. So there are 10 dots, and then after I reach all the 10 dots, then that was one trial. The features, they looked at the speed, how fast I get from one dot to the next one, and obviously if I have to search for a dot first, the time is running already, then the speed will be lower. They looked at the deviation from a straight line, so they looked at this curve again, and they looked where the maximum deviation, that could be here, where the maximum deviation from that straight line was, and they looked at how much that was. Then they defined an angle actually as the angle between the begin point. Let's see if this one works. The begin point, the point of maximum deviation, and then the end point. So this angle they looked at. And if you assume that you'll go above and below that line, then I get an angle here, and I get an angle here, for the maximum deviation below and the maximum deviation above. So I have a positive and a negative angle. I have two angles, or they have two angles. And so those are the features that I calculate: the speed, the maximum deviation, and the two angles. And then they had, as enrollment, somebody had to perform that task 20 times. They calculated the features from that. From every attempt, between every two dots, they could calculate speed, they could calculate maximum deviation, and they could calculate positive and negative angle. And then they could average that for all these things. And so you get 16 features between every pair of dots. From that description, it seems to be that the dots appear in same position every time. So every trial, the first dot and the first dot on the second trial will be in the same positions, etc. Yeah, so they get the average, the standard deviation, the maximum, and the minimum of all the four features that they extract. between every pair of dots. So they get 16 features between two pairs of dots. There are 10 dots, so there are 9 pairs of dots. So they get 144 features. Average over these 20 trials. And then they normalize everything so that the boundaries of the range are known. They had 15 users in their experiment, all youngsters, so apparently it's done at the university with the students. They had a controlled environment, meaning that all of the participants use the same mouse, use the same computer. So the conditions for all participants are exactly the same. And they got a performance between 15 and 20%, depending on how they did the analysis. Relatively easy for a user to perform. At some point he will learn where the dots appears and it will get faster and faster. The performance is not that good. Even worse performance we will see here. Follow the maze. In this case, we had horizontal and vertical moves, and we had what we called vertical and horizontal tracks. And so some of the questions that we had beforehand, if I have to go around the corner, so here's the first track ending and the second track beginning. Yeah. So how do I make that move around the corner? Am I really going straight and then straight? Or am I more or less like a race car, cutting the corner as narrow as I can? And so that could be different for different people. How much variation if I have, let's say, a horizontal track again? And I have to move through this horizontal track. That's not correct, this one. Yeah, I'm in principle, no matter how I cut, I'll make the corner, I'll move in a more or less straight line here. Yeah? But in fact, what I will do is I'll make some movements also in the other direction, in the y direction in this case, and similar. Yeah? So how much movement am I making in the other direction? So not the track direction, but the opposite direction. Yeah, I can look at the speed in the y direction in this case and take some average of that. Yeah. So how much variation is there in the non-movement direction? Again, we thought that might be user specific. So here we see you can't see the red crosses, but every time that the system decided now we're moving from a horizontal to a vertical track or the other way around, it put a cross. Well, here is one in the beginning. And then we have a cross here, so we're going horizontal here, and now we're going vertical. Here it's very clear, obviously, it should be on this spot. Yeah. So these are really tight corners, I would say. Here, maybe, and here, maybe the corner is not that clear. So the system has to, at some point, determine where the corner is taken. If you would have a line going from a diagonal on that angle, you can clearly say when somebody is moving from horizontal to vertical. Although you could also assume that somebody goes beyond that and only turns down there. So it's a difficult problem to really separate the information, the movement, into horizontal and vertical tracks. So that was the first task. Split this into tracks, in horizontal and vertical tracks. In the end, it appeared that the best performance was actually when we did not split it in tracks, but just looked at it as one long movement. This is the speed, actually, that we have from that track, and then these are the movements. Blue is the speed in the, I have to think, blue is the speed in the x direction, and red is the speed in the y direction. And actually, this particular speed, you see some speed in the y direction and little speed in the x direction, but there is some tremble there. Actually, that corresponded to that particular track. Yeah, this first one is the long track in the beginning, etc. So you can count on that. So the next one, there is a movement, there is speed in the x direction and hardly any speed in the y direction. So that's that long track. And then we can analyze that, and we have to split this up. Obviously, you see that the signal is has very much noise on it. So we had to do some noise reduction. The original signal, depending on what kind of filtering we did, we get different signals. This is moving average filtering, which has a tendency to lower the signal, to take away the peaks. This is weighted moving average, which also has a tendency, but much less than the moving average. And so the next step would be to split this into horizontal movements and vertical movements. And this is a vertical movement. So from green to red is always a horizontal. From red to green is a vertical movement, and et cetera, et cetera. And if we could detect indeed 18 different tracks, then we were happy because that was assumed to be correct. And then we had 28 participants in the experiment. It was uncontrolled. So you got the software, use your own computer, use your own mouse. So different types of mouse were used. A hand mouse, not the touchpad. Nobody was using the touchpad. Each participant had to complete this maze 30 times, 5 times per session, and then 6 sessions, spread out a bit, so that it didn't become an automatism right away, although you learned a bit over time anyway. We split the data into 9+9 tracks. And in, for example, a horizontal speed, we assumed that the vertical speed would be 0, but there was some variation in that. We knew that beforehand. And so the features that we were looking at was the speed in the track direction and the variation of the speed in the other direction. And so the deviation from 0. And the best result, actually, when we were not splitting it up in tracks but using it as one, was when using dynamic time warping, and we got only a 26% equal error rate. So not very good results, but I think that in the data there is more information for better results. Dynamic time warping is something you haven't heard of, I assume. So very briefly, something on dynamic time warping. It's also called at a distance or Levenstein distance, depending on the field that you're coming from. I'm coming from, I did my PhD in coding theory, and there it was Levenstein distance. In computer science, it was called at a distance, and now, yeah, dynamic time warping is again used also in biometrics. Opposite to Manhattan distance, scale Manhattan distance, Euclidean distance, whatever, those operate on input sequences of the same length. I can compare one sequence to another sequence as long as they have the same length. Dynamic time warping doesn't require that. In dynamic time warping, I can calculate the distance between sequences of unequal length, which I have, because the time that it takes to go through the maze varies per person and between persons, obviously. Yeah, and so the number of samples that I collect when I go through the maze once and I go to the maze the next time, that's a different number of samples. And still I have to make a comparison. And so that's why we use dynamic time warping. You could do it in a different way. You could just map everything to a fixed length or something like that. But yeah, that's not what we chose. In dynamic time warping, we actually use 3 different operations. In Euclidean distance or Manhattan distance, you just look at changing one symbol into another symbol. So what is the difference between the 2 symbols? And the difference is 0 if the symbol is the same, and the difference is something if the symbols are, or the elements are, have a different value. But in dynamic time warping, or the other one, whatever you want to call it, we can also look at delete or insert a symbol. So this is very abstract, but let's simply go to an example. I want to change the word muddy into the word study. So how would you do that? I have the word muddy, and I have the word study. How can I change one into the other? There's one obvious way of doing it. I change the M into an S, I change the U into a T, and I change the D into a U. So then I don't have muddy, I have, let's see, S, T, U, and the other ones I didn't change, D, Y. So I have study. So three operations. And this, in this case, I just count operations to keep it simple. Yeah, changing the D into a U, you could say, yeah, that has a kind of a higher cost because these are far away in the alphabet. Maybe U to T, those are close in alphabetical order, so that has a lower cost. But in this case, forget about that. For the concept of dynamic time warping, just look at the number of changes that we make. Yeah, so changing study into muddy, I can do with three operations. Actually, then it's muddy and study had the same length anyway. But here is an alternative way. We have muddy. And in study, I also have a U, right? But the U from muddy was first changed into a T, and then I have another letter changing that into the U. That sounds silly at some point, yeah? So what if I would have study like this? Yeah, so I have that mapping from a U to a U, from a D to a D, and from a Y to a Y. And just, I have, let's use a different one, and you have colors. I change the M into a T, I insert the S, and I delete the D. So that's an alternative way. Now I deleted the first D, I could have deleted the second D. Yeah, if we're just talking in the number of operations, this is equally costly as this one. Right? I have three operations, no difference. Yeah, but if we would assign different costs to different operations, yeah, one might be preferable over the other. But this money and study, both five letters, so that's something we can anyway do. But when we have misses and mystery, yeah, six letters and seven letters. So we do need insertions and deletions to get from misses to mystery. And maybe not deletions in this particular case, but at the very least we need insertions. So we can change M is the same, we can change the I into a Y, we can keep the S, then we change the S into a T, then we have the E, then we can change the S into a Y. And we still have the R, so we have to insert the R after the E in this case. And then I wrote change an empty symbol into an R. So what we just simply do, so we have misses, we insert an extra symbol such that the starting and the ending word have the same length. And I inserted it in this case here, because I'm changing I'm inserting this R right after the E. So I'm entering the empty symbol there. The way to calculate the dynamic time warping distance between misses and mystery, yeah, that's a just trial and error. Where should I put that extra symbol? Or should I put maybe more extra symbols here and here also and have some more deletions and insertion? I don't know. But we have to do it in such a way that, let's say, the number of blue operations are as little as possible. Black means no change, right? Blue means a change. So if I go back to muddy and study, this is the second one that I did. Again, I have three blue ones, three operations. I have an empty symbol change into an S, so an insertion of an S, a change of an M into a T, and the deletion of a D, change of a D into the empty symbol. So very basic about dynamic time warping. I don't want to go into much detail here. Just know that dynamic time warping is a way of comparing sequences of unequal length, and certainly very, because look at the name dynamic time warping, the time scale is warped somehow to match the input to the output. Yeah, so time related sequences like moving a mouse, like writing a signature, like gate in a couple of weeks' time, those are very well suited for dynamic time warping. Okay, good. so much dynamic time morphing, so much the static mouse results. Let's look at continuous quickly. We follow here the work by Ferrer and others, who has done some interesting work on continuous mouse dynamics. He looked at mouse actions at four different levels, and each level was building actually on the previous level. So at the lowest level, at level zero, it's very basic. A mouse move, a mouse button down, or a mouse button up. Yeah, left and right. That's really what I can do with the mouse. I can push it so that it moves, I can click one of the buttons down, or I can release one of the buttons. That's all that I can do with a mouse. So those were the level zero type of mouse actions. Then mouse actions at level... and for each of these, I can actually collect the data. When did this happen? What event type, which of these events did I do? Which of these actions did I perform? When and where? So mouse move is not the full mouse move. It's just a slight movement of the mouse. Then they have a number of level one actions. A left click is what a left click is. You press it down and you release it. So a left up directly following a left down. And right click, obviously similar. Yeah, following shortly after a left down. Yeah, so it's not like clicking, moving, and then releasing. No, it's short time. Two other ones is a mouse move sequence. So a number of consecutive move events. So level one action. All close together in time. So it's not like I'm moving it, and then I'm waiting, and then I'm moving it again. No, each event should be close to its predecessor. Drag and drop, similar to a left click, as we have discussed before, except that there is a long time between the left the left down and the left up event. Even if I would not move the mouse, if I would just hover over a window and I would click on the top bar and I would still stay still without moving and then releasing it again, that would still be considered as a drag and drop. Slowly clicking on an OK button is, in this case, considered as a drag and drop. Click, away, no. That's drag. Level 2 actions, again, built on level 1 actions. A mouse move and a double click. Double click is clear, of course, two left clicks close together. And then the mouse move is a mouse move sequence. Events close together. But this should end with silence. So after the last mouse move, there should be a while where there's nothing. Really nothing. So not even... not a move, let's put it like this. And then at the third level, we're actually combining level 1 and level 2 actions. A mouse move left click, mouse move right click, double click, and drag and drop. So everything in principle starts with a mouse move, because generally the mouse pointer is not at the location where I want to do a particular action. I have to move it there, and then I do an action. This is what we call the point and click before. That's now mouse move left click. Graphically, we can show it like this. So a left click is a left down and a left up. The mouse move sequence is a number of mouse moves, etc., etc. Drag and drop is either a left or a right down, followed by move, and then that same button up again. So this is the raw data again that they collect. Yeah, for a mouse move sequence, let's say a mouse move, we have a mouse move sequence followed by nothing, so we have a number of mouse moves, and the number of mouse moves was event, M in this case, location and time. Left click is a left down and a left up, so left down event, location and time, left up event, location and time. So Those are the raw features. What are the features that we can use then in the analysis? A left click would give me two features. Would give them two features, I should say. They can measure the time that the click took, and I can measure the distance that the mouse moved within that click. If I would have a double click, I would actually have six features. Two times two for the first and the second click, and actually also in between for the, let's say, the latency, we have the time and the displacement, the distance. So left click is two features, and a double click is six features. They extracted 66 features for a mouse move. So much more than we discussed in this class. There are many different ways of coming up to all these features. And there are more features, if you want, than these 66. Just be creative in coming up with something. A drag and drop. How much features would a drag and drop then be? Would it be 66, or would it be maybe because there is a click in there, or there's a mouse button usage in there? Would it be 68, or what do you think? Who votes 66? Who votes 68? Who doesn't vote? It's actually the same. It's also 66. Same features also. Why? Actually, the it doesn't matter if I start with a left button down and end up with a left button. The time, for example, between that is meaningless. So the features and the distance is meaningless because that's all in the move already that is in between there. Yeah, so these two features, time and distance, are in these 66 features already from the mouse one. If I would combine, if I look at level 3, mouse move, left click. I have 66 features from the mouse move. I have two features from the mouse click. And obviously, there is this small time in between and the small maybe displacement. So those two features from, let's say, the latency in between. Yeah, same here. Same for these two. Mouse move, double click. 66 from the mouse move. 6 from the double click and 2 from the time between the mouse move and the double click. Mouse move, drag and drop. 66 plus 2 plus 66 again. A huge number of features. Okay, so what they did, they had a number of users and a number of, let's start here. They, for each of these different actions, level 1, 2, 3 actions, they created a model. And that model, that machine learning model, that was one model for all users together. So there was one model that described a mouse move. And that on input data would output one of the users that was delivering the data here. There were 25 users in this case. So it would come up with the identity of one of these 25 people. And the assumptions that they made was the following. Or what they wanted to test was the following. If there are n users, and there are n actions of a single unknown user, then I will use each of, I look what kind of action this is, I look at the model for that action, and I'll ask the machine learning model, the correct machine learning model, what is the probability that this particular action came from this user? If I would sum this over all users, I would add up to one, of course. Right? Is that clear? So given a single action, one of these actions, I'll get the probabilities from that, from the related machine learning model. I get the probability that it is user 1 or user 2 or user 3, etc., etc., all the way up to user n. And I call that probability ij. This is a real probability. But I don't have just a single action. I have more actions. I have m actions. So I can look at the first user, let's say user I, and I look at all the actions and all the probabilities that were assigned to that user. Probability that the first action is from that user is this, and the probability that the second action is from that user is this, etc., etc. And I add that all. And obviously, it's not a probability anymore, because this value can very well be more than one. But anyway, just for notification, that is what I, for now, call the probability I. for user I. Then I can look at all these probabilities for all these end users, and I can add them up. And I use this, again, not a probability. I can use this to normalize everything again. So now I can define the probability that these M actions came from user I. That's related to this value, of course. But they're divided by the sum of all those probabilities. So I said I get back to probabilities again. Now if I would, now this will be a number between 0 and 1. And if I sum up all these numbers for all users, I'll end up with the value 1, clearly. So now I have a number of actions. And for each user, I know the probability that those actions came from that particular user. If I would do identification, I would say that, yeah, this is the, if this value is, the, or this for this user, it's the highest value. So that will be the one that I identify, rank one, that is. Yeah, if we authenticate, then I say that, yes, I thought this was user one. I calculated this value. If it's high enough, then I accept that. Yeah, so there is a difference between authentication and identification, of course. So how did they do? Well, 25 participants, 4 female, the rest male. They used the number of different types of mouse devices. The data that they collected for each user was split 50-50. Half of it was done, was used for the training of these machine learning algorithms, and half of it was done for the testing. On average, they wrote, on average, 15 and a half hours of training data per user. With a 50-50 split, that means on average a user delivered 31 hours of mouse action, which is a lot. Which means that it's the environment is not restricted, it's unrestricted. Everybody was using his own machine, and they are just performing their normal daily business, and then that information is collected and sent to the to Fair and his group. So a lot of that. 15 and a half hours, that's like 2 days of working, right? That sounds like a lot, and it doesn't really mean that much. How much do you use the mouse in 15 hours, in two days? Well, now I'm just talking. Not using the mouse at all. Yeah, once in a while I'll click, or I think I even use the spacebar to go to the next slide. Yeah, so I'm not using the mouse at all. And then time flies. Right, so it doesn't say anything about the amount of data. It just said that they collected data for, let's say, 4 or 5 days on average. I'm using the spacebar, in fact. Anyway, let's look at the results. If they looked at each and every separate action, so one action, and I determine who the user was, then they got an equal error rate of 26.25%, very high. So that should obviously not be a reason to lock the system. Just looking at one action and then they're out. So they also looked at longer. And obviously the more information I get, yeah, I might be wrong on some of them, yeah, but the more information I get, the more correct information I get also, and that will improve the performance. So with 30 actions, then the equal error rate went down to 8.5. 100 actions, 7.5. It's not going that fast down anymore, of course. If you read this, 7.5% equal error rate, 100 actions, then obviously you all realize that this was not actually continuous authentication. It's periodic authentication. System is open, it's collecting mouse activity. When it has seen 100 actions, it will make a decision. That's what it does. And based on these 100 actions, I have a 7.5% probability that I will be locked out, or an attacker has a 7.5% probability that he can stay inside my system. Next week, we'll talk about continuous authentication. and actually we'll see a way to, in continuous authentication, we're looking at each and every single action and using each and every single action to make a decision to lock out a user or not. Yeah, if I would use this system, after four mouse actions, I would be locked out at least once. That's probably not a good system. If I just would look at each single action separately. In a continuous system, obviously, we have some knowledge about what happened in the past, so we'll not consider each and every single single action. But we'll the performance analysis in continuous authentication, or the performance reporting in continuous authentication, is no longer in equal error rate. I will keep it to next week as a surprise in what it is, but we'll see that we can actually take these results of periodic authentication and translate them also to that other performance measurement. But that's next week. So for now, that was the information that I had on mouse dynamics. Any questions? If not, then let me see how many slides I have for the... Yeah, I think we can have a 15-minute break. Yeah? Is that okay? Good. Okay, then I'll see you after the break. Okay, so
let me see where we are.
So I'll say something about the history of signature verification. I will give a small introduction, and then we'll look at a full system, what components we find there, and then I will give an example from literature that in a bit more detail. So the history. One of the first publications was in 1929 already, from a guy called Osborne. He looked at signatures, recognizing signatures, obviously without a computer. They were not available in 1929, but he looked at them manually and from a forensic point of view, so to determine if a signature was real or if it was a fake signature. The first work on, or one of the first works on automatic signature verification was from 1965 already, and obviously, like in all areas, there is a number of overview papers, the first in 77, but then after that many followed. In that work by Herbst and Liu, they also used accelerometer data to recognize signatures. Popular analysis methods is dynamic time warping, again, because we have a time series, and hidden Markov models. I will not go into that now. And a few milestones, like in any biometric, available of a benchmark database is very important, because then people can check their algorithms based on a single database, which is obviously better if I have my database of 6 people or 25 people or whatever we saw earlier today. My algorithm performs very well on my database, but it doesn't mean anything about how it will perform on another database. So having a benchmark database available is very important. There are a number of benchmark databases available in signature verification. And also competitions where a particular database is made available and where all groups are asked to perform an analysis on that data and see which one gets the best performance. Okay, let's look at the introduction. So what is signature verification? Obviously, it has to do with writing your own name or writing something that represents your name in a personalized way. Yeah, there is a bunch of signatures we have here, Queen Elizabeth, and on top, her mother or grandmother or whoever. There is people we know, Steve Jobs is here, Bill Gates is here. So everybody has their own specific signature. Our President Trump from, this is not a fake signature, this is a real signature, apparently. Does anybody know who this person is, the one above Trump? Maybe you can read the signature, I can't. Anyway, we'll get to her in a second. Here's another one that I found, Nelson Mandela, who has some overlap with what all the scribbling that Trump does. Some people use very specific signatures. You will see the first one again, the one that I just asked. J.K. Rowling, apparently. I didn't know her from the picture. I just found out by coincidence. Yeah, some people have really scribblings or drawing or whatever. But anyway, it is a way of expressing our identity in writing, and it is a consistent way of doing that. Obviously, the next time I write my signature, it will not be exactly the same as this drawing, but it will very much be alike. Yeah, this person will not write all of a sudden something like this. Yeah, he will stick to that way of writing his signature. When we talk about signatures, we talk about forgeries. Yeah, not just in biometric signature verification, but in general life also, because signatures are important in claiming an identity, or verifying an identity. They are in passports, they are on money checks, they are on paintings or whatever. So people try to forge signatures all of the time. So here we have an example. Up on the top is a gentleman's signature. And then we have different types of fakes that we consider. The first fake is what we call a random forgery. That person has no idea of the other person's name, of the other person's signature, and he just tries to make a signature, his own signature most likely. Yeah, there is no relation between the two signatures other than one was made by one person, one was made by another person, and they do that probably in a consistent way, and we can distinguish between them. So if we have a system where everybody writes his own signatures and I compare my signature to your signature, then we call that a random forgery. Compare this to keystroke dynamics, where we have the password, the typing of the password, and where everybody types his own password. Everybody writes his own signature here. Yeah? The second is a simple forgery. Okay, this person probably knew the name, and if you look at them, then you probably see that the same name is used, if you can, or you see some similarities there. A simple forgery. I know something about this signature, or I know something about this person, in this case the name, and I'll just try something. Yeah, this in B, the person wrote his own signature. In C, the person assumed, made an assumption on what the signature was of this person. And could very well have been something like that. While in the last case, we have what is called a skilled forgery. This person has seen this signature, has seen maybe this person write a signature. So he has a lot of knowledge. And at the very least, he can try to mimic the shape of the signature. Maybe even the dynamics of writing the signature. So there is a difference in what kind of forgeries we consider. And generally, if everybody writes his own signature and then we start comparing, we call that zero effort or random forgery. Yeah, and the more really active forging there is, the more we get to this skilled forgery. Often it's very difficult to detect forgeries. Here we see a genuine signature again, and if you look closely at these two forgeries, it's very difficult to find the difference. This is a tracking. So meaning I'm really going over this top signature and trying to have the same shape. Yeah, and this is a forged freehand where I see the signature and I try to copy it. Yeah, there was a question.
B, is that really forgery if you just write your own signature?
This one, yeah. We call that zero effort or random effort. So like in keystroke dynamics, you have an 8-character password, I have an 8-character password, I compare your typing dynamics against my typing dynamics, which is unrelated. Yeah, but yeah, it is called a forgery, but it is not in the sense that we normally think about forging a real signature. Right? If we want to find that these are indeed forgeries compared to this one, which is general, you have to look at details. Yeah, you see here in the details that the authentic signature looks different from the forged signature. And that's not taken from this, but this is from somewhere else. Yeah, so we have to look, if we want to rule out forgeries, false matches, in case of biometric signature recognition, we have to look at the details and not just at the global signature. How do we get these signatures? Well, these are clearly written on paper and scanned, etc., etc., because these are old signatures. But we can distinguish between online and offline capturing. In offline, we capture just with pen and paper, like we always do. And in online, we use a special equipment, a special tablet where we write on it. Yeah, if you ever have been to the, if you ever get a package sent to you, you have to sign with the DHL courier, or you go to the post office and you have to sign, or the bank, you have to sign on these small tablets. Yeah, and right away, the result is inside the computer. So here, the signing is electronic immediately. Here, I have to scan it. Yeah, you write it on paper, I have to go to the copying machine and put it on there and make a scan of it before I have it. So what's the difference then? In this case, I only have the shape. Everything was ready before I made an electronic version of it, so I only can look at the shape of the signature. I can play a bit with it, but I don't have the dynamics. While here, I have the shape, obviously, but I also have information about the dynamics. Yeah? When writing this signature, where was the movement fast? Where was the movement slow? In what order was it written? Yeah, if I write a P, I can write the bar first and then this round thing, or I can do it the other way around. Maybe that's a typical way of doing it. Yeah, in offline capture, I can't see that at the end. In an online capture, I can see exactly what is done when. Obviously, human signature recognition is used a lot in offline capture. And in online capture, we have a lot more information available. So we will focus on online capturing. There are some problems with that, of course. This area where to sign has a specific dimension and a specific reaction time, exactly as I said with the mouse, writing a signature with the mouse. If there is a reaction time. At the post office and you're signing for something, you make a draw, and you wait, oh, and there it is, right? There is a reaction time that can lead to hesitations and everything. Sometimes that area is rather small, and so you have to restrict the people who have large loops in their signature. That's not possible on such a device. If you have handheld devices, if somebody from DHL is coming to your door, then you even have less room to write the signature. So that restricts it somehow. Yeah, but nowadays we go over to consumer electronics as a capture device, and so if I have a tablet that responds very fast, I know that the Surface tablet was designed to have a very fast response time, then writing on a large 10-inch tablet, your signature, yeah, then I see immediately what I'm doing, and I get plenty of room to write my signature. The forgeries, zero effort, random effort, as we just mentioned, and the skilled effort. So in the first case, we never seen the signature of the person, might not even know the name of this person, and in skilled forgeries, we have information about the signature of the victim available. Maybe just the name, maybe probably also the shape of the signature, and so we have some more. So here we might or might not know the name of the signature. In case of skilled forgeries, I might even have been present at the signing process. So I don't have just the shape. I maybe have seen where somebody is slow or where somebody is fast. Maybe I have a recording of that. I might even practice offline. Yeah, I see you write your signature, and I'll go and try to mimic that. Maybe I have a video, and I can compare that. So I have some practice there. As I said, this is the analogy with the keystroke dynamics where everybody has his own password. Okay, so let's look at a signature verification system. Here we have it. At the bottom, I have a capturing device, and then there are a number of steps before I make a decision on accept or reject. So what steps do we have in between? What blocks do we have in between? Well, first there is a data acquisition and pre-processing. So that's here, and then from that pre-processing, after the data acquisition pre-process, we are starting to extract the features. Once we are able to do that, we can enroll the person. Yeah, I have a number of writing a signature, and I extract the information from each of these, I don't know, 10 times that somebody writes a signature, I extract the information from that, and I use that for enrollment to create the reference. And later on, I'll use the same information for the matching. And if I do that, I have to maybe do some pre-alignment, making sure that these fit. Yeah, what if I wrote a signature on an A4 paper, where I have plenty of room, or on a small device from the DHL person? And then you can do some score normalization at the end. Let's look at each of these modules in more detail. So the data acquisition and pre-processing, as said, this is online capturing, so we have some specialized device that can capture the information. So what kind of raw information can we detect? Well, timing information and location information, we detect that always. And so the pen is on the tablet and the pen is writing, and it detects every time where the tip of the pen is in over a period of time, and then based on that I have time and location information. Depending on the quality of the signing device, I could maybe also know something about the pressure. Is it the pen just slightly touching the tablet, or somebody pressing hard, or maybe, yeah, how does that vary over time when writing the signature? Maybe there is a dot at the end where there is a lot of pressure, or maybe it's a small dot, or whatever. Yeah, so we can measure pressure, or some devices can measure pressure. Some pens also have, signing pens also have hardware in them where they can measure the tilt. Am I holding the pen straight up, or yeah? So this kind of information. Obviously, then I assume that the tablet is on a fixed position. If I have a handheld device, yeah, then the pen tilt doesn't mean anything. Yeah, but on a device that is on my table, and I sign there, and I pen tilt information, if available, could give some information too about the identity. Sampling rate of these devices nowadays is between 100 and 200 samples per second, which is plenty of sufficient. In terms of pre-processing steps, what you could do, and all of this is optional, of course, you could do some noise filtering. Yeah, there is some noise in some tremble maybe in the writing of the signature. There could be some noise in the capturing of the location information, and we could filter all of that out. In some cases, we have seen that in research they did some resampling in order to get equidistant points. So not so much if I write this, yeah, then I have in time. And all of a sudden I'm going faster, so they are further apart, and then I'm slowing down. Right? But I could resample and make sure that all the samples are at equal distance of each other. There are advantages and disadvantages. What's the disadvantage to this? And one of the disadvantages is that I lose speed information. Not necessarily, I could keep track if this is time t0, and this is time t1, where I add a real sample. I could add information about how the typing information. But generally, that was not done in that particular research where they had equidistant points, so then some information was lost. Anyway, I have my data now. I've done some pre-processing on it if needed. And then from that raw data, this kind of information, I'm going to extract my features. And because most of the research only has timing and location information available, that's what we'll focus on. We'll forget about the others. When I extract features, when I extract discriminative information, actually there are two ways I can do that. I can do that feature-based, or I can do that function-based. When I do that feature-based, then what I do is I'll extract some global information. The size of the signature was this, the time it took to write it was this, etc. On the full signature. If we have function-based information, then again this time series comes into play again. I have some dynamic information there. So I can calculate speed, I can calculate acceleration, exactly the same as what I could do with mouse dynamics. The set of features that I extract can either be global, everybody the same type of features, or it can be user-specific. Obviously, if I do user-specific, I'll select for each user the features that is most discriminative, most prominent for that particular user present. So I get a better performance when I do that. But obviously it has a cost also. Function-based, so having the time series, performs generally better than feature-based. Why? I have more information available. I don't have just global features. I have the timing information there also. And personal features generally perform better than global features. Yeah, that sounds logical also. During the enrollment, like in any behavioral biometrics, we have to have a number of samples to create a reference template. It's not just one sample, like in fingerprint or face. We have a number of samples that we need. So assume that we have case signatures, that the data of case signatures available, and I use that for training. Then again, I can look at two different models. I can have a reference-based model, or I can have a model-based model method. In the second case, I'll create some kind of average over the features of these K signatures, while in the first case, I just keep them all. If I want to create a meaningful average, obviously, I can't average over two signatures. That average, it has no meaning. Yeah. So if I have a large number of signatures available for the training, then I can go to the model-based method. If not, I should stick to the reference-based. But obviously, if I have a lot of data available and I'm doing reference-based, then I got an issue later on with the testing, because I'm not comparing a new signature to just some kind of average signature, but I'm comparing it to all K of these signatures that I kept, features of those signatures. Yeah, and obviously that multiplies the time that I need to do the comparison. Pre-alignment and the similarity computation. What people looked at is kind of normalizing the orientation and the size of a signature. Yeah, if I have a signature that I write upward, somebody writes a signature upward, I could just decide to have the orientation of the signature horizontal within a specific frame of a particular size. Yeah, such that if I do that for all signatures, then everybody is equal. Yeah, then it's independent of, or slightly independent of, the size of the area that I had available. Obviously, I'm physically restricted by a smaller area. Yeah, but if I have a large tablet available, I'll make a large signature. If I have a smaller tablet available, I'll make a smaller signature. Yeah, but they should still be considered the same from the same person. And so when I make sure that the size is the same by boxing them in a particular size, and then I can compensate for that. In comparison, what we have to do is look at how the reference was made and what kind of features I use. So each setting will have a different kind of optimal way of doing that. So if I have feature-based information and I have a reference-based enrollment, then a distance metric like Euclidean distance or a train classifier like a neural network is the best way to go ahead. But if I have feature-based information but model-based enrollment, then statistical models could perform better. If I have function-based information, yeah, then that could be either local or global information. And again, based on that, I choose a method that gives me the best performance. And score normalization is done mostly if you want to combine multiple analysis methods together. Yeah, if one of them will give you a score between 0 and 20 and the other one gives you a score between 0 and 1, you can not simply merge them. You can't simply do fusion. You have to make sure that they are at the same scale. Otherwise, if you're just using a single classifier, then score normalization is not needed, of course, because it's just a linear scaling. Okay, good. Let's look at an example from literature, and there we focus for a part on the features that they are extracting. I'll follow the work by Jane and Greece and Connell. This was actually work done by Greece for master thesis, I believe, or a PhD thesis, I don't recall that, but this is an article based on that. And here we see a signature from one of the participants, and if I zoom in on part of that, you get this. It's not really zoom in, it's not that much bigger. Let's look at what they thought was interesting. And they defined something which was called critical points. And in these critical points, in a signature, they were extracting features. Yeah, and they did not extract features everywhere on the signature, but only in the critical points. So what is a critical point? That's either an endpoint of a stroke or a change in trajectory. And a stroke was from putting the pen down, making a move, to lifting the pen. So here, one stroke, second stroke, third, four, five, six, seven strokes. So endpoint of a stroke, that's clear. That's from where you start until where you end. Where you start until where you end. And then we have a change of the trajectory. That is a change of direction. I'm moving to the right, and then I'm turning and moving back to the left. Then here we have a change of directory. Trajectory. Yeah, same with all the other directions. Or if I'm going into, let's say, a horizontal direction, and then I'm turning up or down. And that point, that last point, is also a critical point. Once I have identified the critical points, I want to describe such a point. I want to extract features from that point. So what kind of features did they look at? Well, I looked at a lot of things. When they looked at a particular point, they considered not just that point, but they considered two points to the left and two points to the right, two succeeding and two preceding points. They looked at only the y location. I'm actually not sure why they only considered the y location of that point, not the x location, but that's what they did. They looked at the change in values, in x and y value, so the change in location between the point that I'm considering and the next point. So I'm here now in this critical point. The next point will be delta x and delta y change in the location. They looked at the angle between the x-axis and the line through these two points. On the next slide, we'll have a picture, so then it will become more clear. They looked at the curvation, which is saying something about the curve that the signature is following, and they looked at 9 grayscale values that I will explain on the next slide. Notice that when I'm looking at an angle, I have to be very careful, because if I have I'm looking at angles, then this is like 45 degrees, right? And this is like, if I go here, that will be like 2 degrees. And if I go slightly here, that will be like 358 degrees. Those angles are very close together, but the difference is very large, of course. So what they did is they did not consider alpha by itself, but they considered the cosine and the sine of alpha. And then it doesn't matter that I'm going over this 360 boundary. That's all by that. The number of features for each critical point that they described is 1 for the location, 2 for the delta x and delta y. The angle is then described in 2 features also. The curvation is just as it is, so that's 1 feature, and then 9 grayscale values. So that's 15 features. So each of these critical points is 15 features. Yeah, and if I look at the number of, there is an endpoint and a start point of the stroke, and then here the direction is changing, direction. So there's a lot of critical points in each stroke. And not all of them, obviously, such a small stroke has much less critical points. Anyway, these are the features that we talked about. They have the y value. And then they have, if they look at point PI and the next point PI plus 1, there is a change in x value and a change in y value. So that's two points that they have. Then they have the line through these two points, and that will make a particular angle with the x-axis. The alpha is there. The curvation is, I'll take a line through pi minus 2 and pi, and I'll take a line through pi and pi plus 2, and so that line is changing direction. I'm going from this all the way to this, so I have a curvation here. And then if I look at a pixel level, I see here my point pi. This is a change of direction in this case, as you see. So this is my critical point. And I'll make a 9 times 9 area around that, which I then again split up in 3 times 3 blocks. And for each block, I'll count how many points of this of the curve are on the are in such a block. So here there's no 0 and 0 and 0, and here is just 2 pixels I use, and here 3 and 3, 3 again here, and then 0 and 0. Yeah, so the gray values is coded as 0, 0, 0, 2, 3, 3, 3, 0, 0. Yeah, and if the curve would come from up here, yeah, then these values would change also. So we'll say something about the area local to the critical point. Yeah, that was very short on the features that they looked at, just to give you an impression of what kind of features can be used in signature verification. Others will use different points again. Any questions? That was the last slide. Any questions on signature verification? Okay. If not, then next week it will be continuous authentication, where I will focus mostly on keystroke dynamics, and keystroke dynamics will also be in the exercise session this afternoon. I found my software again. Okay, then I'll see you at 1:15.